Today is Tuesday, January 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. reacts to North Korea's missile launch.
Ballistic missile programs is a threat to international peace and security.
Some Palestinians are calling on leader Mahmoud Abbas to step down.
His rule over the last decade has become more and more authoritarian, that there is no independence for the judiciary.
And 100,000 people have died from COVID in Poland. We'll have these stories and more next. Not even 2 weeks into the new year, North Korea has already conducted two missile launches. VOA's Bill Gallo has the latest from Seoul.
The latest North Korean missile splashed into the sea off Korea's east coast early Tuesday. Details are sparse, but South Korea's military suggests the missile shared similarities with North Korea's missile test last week. North Korea on Thursday claimed a successful test of a new hypersonic missile. At the time, South Korea's government said that claim was exaggerated. But on Tuesday, the South acknowledged North Korea's latest launch may have seen improvements. Though neither missile flew over Japan, the launches are rattling North Korea's neighbors. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said it is very regrettable that North Korea continues the launches. South Korea also expressed strong regret at the tests. The latest launch came hours after the United Nations Security Council held a closed-door meeting to discuss the previous launch. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield, spoke after the meeting.
The DPRK's continued pursuit of weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs is a threat to international peace and security. This launch is the latest in a series of ballistic missile launches and shows the DPRK's determination to expand its unlawful weapons capability.
North Korea is prohibited from any ballistic missile activity by a series of UN Security Council resolutions. In an end-of-year speech, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un spoke of the need to improve his country's defense capabilities without a moment's delay. He has rejected repeated U.S. offers to resume nuclear talks, saying the United States must first drop what it calls a hostile policy. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas's political future is in question as signs point to growing discontent among Palestinians, with many of them saying they want him to step down. As Linda Gradstein reports from the West Bank town of Ramallah, the Palestinian leader's popularity is dipping despite his efforts to work with the Israelis to improve conditions for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is struggling for his political survival, as polls show that about 80% of Palestinians surveyed indicate they want him to resign. His popularity did not improve after his recent meeting with Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz, when Israel announced gestures to ease Palestinian living conditions.
There doesn't seem to be any hope that conditions will in any meaningful way change, whether in terms of their relationship with the Israelis, in terms of ending occupation or even easing the occupation, or in terms of reforms within the PA, going to elections, for example, or reconciling the West Bank and Gaza, Fatah and Hamas, or improving economic conditions. Overall, the picture that is in the minds of the Palestinians is that things will get worse rather than get better.
Last year, Palestinians protested what they said was corruption and anti-democratic actions by his administration, including the closure of the parliament, the Palestinian Legislative Council, and the cancellation of every national election during the last 15 years. They blame Mahmoud Abbas.
That his rule over the last decade has become more and more authoritarian, that there is no independence for the judiciary, that there is no free press, that civil society is being constrained, and that for all of this, the reason he's doing all of this is because he wants to stay in power.
Many also condemn what they view as collaboration by Abbas with Israel.
Under President Mahmoud Abbas, the political relationship with the state of Israel and negotiations has totally stopped. And now the PA's role is basically providing security services to the state of Israel. Now, this on the short side might be a good thing for the state of Israel, but in the long run, it discredits the PA and the people's trust in the PA, and therefore it will lessen the ability of the PEA to control, security-wise, the people.
For Israel, Abbas has been a stabilizing force in the West Bank, where his security forces have helped to prevent dozens of Palestinian attacks. Israeli security officials say the only alternative to the Abbas government is Hamas, which they consider a terrorist organization.
The Palestinian Authority, and of course, we don't need to agree on everything. And of course, there are big differences between Israel or the Israeli policy and the Palestinian policy. But we see during the last 10, 15 years, the Palestinian Authority is doing lots of effort to fight Hamas. We can cooperate with them. So we need the Palestinian Authority to be stronger.
Observers, in fact, say the Palestinian Authority is in a position of weakness because it is facing an economic crisis. They believe Abbas had no choice but to talk about economic aid after the Israelis refused to negotiate on the peace process. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Ramallah.
Poland has become the latest nation to reach the grim milestone of 100,000 deaths related to the COVID-19 coronavirus. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Poland's health minister says 493 deaths of people with COVID-19 has been registered in the past 24-hour period, pushing the death toll to over 100,000. The vast majority of the deaths are among people who hadn't been vaccinated, and nearly a quarter of those deaths, some 24,000, occurred in the most recent wave of infection that began in October, a period in which vaccines have been widely available in the EU nation. Poland now joins Italy, Britain, France and Germany as those European nations that have recorded 100,000 deaths. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Undocumented Afghan migrants who have fled to Turkey to escape the Taliban say they are unable to access treatment and vaccines for COVID. While officially registered refugees do qualify for health care in Turkey, it's believed there are thousands of unregistered Afghan migrants in the country. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Erzurum in central Turkey is on a major route for migrants heading west to Europe. It's a stopover for many Afghan refugees. Some settle here and find work. According to official United Nations figures, Turkey is hosting around 183,000 Afghan asylum seekers. But unofficial estimates suggest thousands more Afghan migrants are undocumented, living and working in Turkey under the radar and unable to access basic services like healthcare. Mohammed is among them. He told VOA, "I am from Badakhshan province in Afghanistan. I came to Turkey 2 months ago. I am 18 years old. We have no ID cards, so the hospitals don't treat us." Mohammed works in a local dairy company, along with several other Afghan migrants in Erzurum, including Islam. He told VOA, "There are 8 or 9 people living in this room. 5 people have ID cards and the rest don't. If any of those who don't have an ID card catches coronavirus, the hospitals don't treat them. Those who have no ID card cannot have a vaccine. If they catch coronavirus, we will all catch coronavirus." Several Afghan migrants told VOA they choose not to register as official refugees, fearing arrest and deportation. Many said the status of Afghan refugees remains unclear, and they want clarification from the Turkish government. Turkey has ramped up border security and detained hundreds of Afghan migrants in deportation centres. The Turkish government did not respond to VOA questions on the number of undocumented Afghan migrants or the lack of access to healthcare. Erzurum officials said any unregistered refugees would be arrested. The United Nations says Turkey is hosting around 4 million refugees, 3.7 million of whom are Syrians fleeing conflict. Visiting Turkey in September, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, praised the government for what he called extremely positive policies towards migrants.
My visit here is also an opportunity to appeal to the international community, to donor countries, to international organizations to do more to help Turkey maintain these very generous policies for the refugees that it hosts.
Many Afghans say their status of refugees remains uncertain, so they prefer to live in the shadows as they seek a new life. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
The United Nations is appealing for a record $5 billion to provide life-saving humanitarian assistance to 28 million people in Afghanistan and in five neighboring countries of refuge this year. Lisa Schlein has that story for VOA from Geneva.
The bulk of the funds, $4.4 billion, will provide vital relief for 22 million people in Afghanistan, nearly half of the country's population. This is the largest ever appeal for humanitarian assistance for a single country, but then the needs of this country are enormous. The United Nations warns Afghanistan is becoming one of the world's worst, fastest-growing humanitarian crises. It says half of Afghanistan's population is facing acute hunger. More than 9 million people are internally displaced, and millions of children are out of school. UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs Martin Griffiths says farmers and herders are struggling to survive amid the worst drought in decades. He says people need help to endure the impact of years of conflict and of a shattered economy.
Up to 1 million children under five, if we do not get assistance to them, will suffer from severe and acute malnutrition. We need to get food to the families where they live. We need to get seeds to the farmers where they plow. We need to get health services to the clinics in locations throughout the country. And we need protection services for all those people who want to return home.
Afghanistan is facing a massive problem of internal and external displacement. More than 9 million people are displaced inside the country, about one-third because of conflict. More than 6 million Afghan refugees are living in neighboring countries, mostly in Pakistan and Iran. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Philippa Grandi says it is urgent to help sustain Afghanistan's economy and public services to ward off more large-scale displacements.
If the country collapses, implodes, we've said it so many times, but it's worth repeating, then we may see a much bigger exodus of people. The key issue here is to transform this massive internal displacement, probably the biggest in the world in terms of numbers, and prevent this from becoming a massive external displacement, which is a very major risk at this point.
Grandi urges the international community to do everything it can to prevent a catastrophe in Afghanistan. He warns this would further drive displacement both within the country and throughout the region. The UN says it needs $623 million to support 5.7 million Afghan refugees and the communities hosting them in neighboring countries. The funds will provide protection, health and nutrition, food, shelter, water and sanitation, education, and other essential relief. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Carol Van Dam. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega was sworn into office for his fourth consecutive term on Monday, hours after the United States and European Union imposed sanctions on several figures in his government. Ortega won the November 7th election after most of his political foes were jailed, a move that was widely condemned. U.S. President Biden called the election a pantomime. Most Western leaders shunned the inauguration ceremony on Monday evening, although leftist leaders, including Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, flew in to show their support. In Italy, David Sassoli, the Italian journalist who worked his way up in politics while defending the downtrodden to become president of the European Union's parliament, died in a hospital early Tuesday. The EU consul president called Sassoli a sincere and passionate European. A spokesperson for Sassoli says the 65-year-old socialist had been hospitalized since December 26th due to abnormal functioning of his immune system. A third Chinese city has locked down its residents due to a COVID outbreak. The latest lockdown means about 20 million people are confined to their homes in China. The lockdown of Anyang, which has a population of about 5.5 million people, was announced late Monday after two cases of the Omicron variant were reported. Residents are not allowed to go out. Shops are closed except those selling necessities. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson faced a public backlash on Tuesday over allegations that he and staffers flouted coronavirus lockdown rules by holding a garden party in 2020 when Britons were banned from mingling outside the home. Opposition politicians are calling for a police investigation after broadcaster ITV published a leaked email invitation to socially distanced drinks in the Prime Minister's garden at his Downing Street office and home. U.S. President Joe Biden is heading to the U.S. state of Georgia and the Ebenezer Baptist Church Tuesday to focus attention on the push for voter rights legislation in the United States. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wittig-Cusquara tells me that President Biden is facing pressure to move more aggressively on the threats to voting rights.
According to a senior administration official who previewed the speech, President Biden today will not go so far as to call for a full-scale elimination of the filibuster. This is, again, a Senate tradition, American Senate tradition, that allows a minority party to kill a legislation that fails to garner at least 60 votes. Instead, President Biden will endorse changing Senate rules, what he calls filibuster carve out, to pass these new voting rights protections during his speech. And this is, to be underlined, the most significant step he has taken so far to pressure lawmakers to act on voting rights.
Are some groups boycotting his appearance today in Georgia, saying that the president hasn't moved quickly enough? I'm hearing some reports that some civil rights groups saying they're not happy with the president. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so there's been multiple high-profile voting rights leaders who say that they're planning to skip. They're basically dismissing the speech as too little, too late. You know, the time for speeches is done. We need action. And some of those groups include Black Voters Matter. There are also some voices, including the former NAACP of Georgia, who say that we don't need any more speeches. We just don't need any more platitudes, and we don't need any more photo ops. But we need action right now, and that is actually in the form of these two voting rights bill that are right now in Congress, including the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, as well as the Freedom to Vote Act.
When are the voting rights bills expected to come up for a vote in Congress?
So Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who is a Democrat, he has said that the Senate will vote no later than January 17th. That is Martin Luther King Day. Martin Luther King is, of course, a very prominent civil rights activist from Georgia. And Chuck Schumer said that they will continue to push it through on changing through these Senate rules if Republicans continue to block voting rights legislation. So, again, these two voting rights bills have been blocked by Republicans using the filibuster, which is the Freedom to Vote Act, which would set new minimum standards for early and mail-in voting, among other provisions, while the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act will restore elements of the Voting Rights Act that have already been weakened by the Supreme Court.
Are they expected to come up within as early as this week, within the next couple of days?
Well, we don't know yet, because in order to change the Senate rules, all Democrats need to be on board, right? There are only 50 Democrats in the Senate. And meanwhile, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Senator Kristen Sinema of Arizona, these are the two kind of center Democrats, they have repeatedly defended the legislative filibuster and may not be open to amending it, despite the fact that they do support the voting legislation itself. So it's a lot of legislative maneuvering that needs to be done in Congress in the next couple of days.
And just finally, Patsy, can you explain for our audience why the president chose to go to Georgia to do this speech?
Right. I already mentioned Martin Luther King Jr., who was perhaps the most prominent leader of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. He was born in Atlanta, Georgia. So this is a place where there's just an enormous history of the civil rights movement. Other than Martin Luther King, there's also Coretta Scott King, and then Bernice Albertine King, you know, all these civil rights leaders, including Congressman John Lewis, who President Joe Biden calls a friend, who's also from the areas.
That was VOA White House correspondent Patty Wittig-Cusquara speaking with me on Tuesday. A U.S. Capitol Police officer filed suit against former President Donald Trump on the one-year anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. Brianna Kirkland accuses Trump of causing emotional and physical pain during the attack. It's the latest in a string of suits filed against Trump. Kirkland says Trump played a central role in inciting the insurrection. The lawsuits accuse Trump of violating the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, which prohibits mob violence aimed at obstructing the operations of the federal government and its officers. The title refers to an infamous white supremacy movement that arose after the U.S. Civil War in the 1800s. I asked criminal defense lawyer and former prosecutor Jack Rice what he makes of the lawsuits.
There are people on both sides of this aisle on that law and whether or not they're stretching this law beyond its breaking point. But I do appreciate the thought, because there is a maxim, I think, in the United States that everybody should be held to account. Nobody is above the law, and that we are all responsible for the acts that we commit. And if we look at what it was that the former president did on January 6th of 2020, and what he did and what supporters did at his request, the idea that he would be responsible is something that actually has a very long-standing acceptance in the criminal world, where you say you can be conspiratorially responsible for the acts of others if you were working in concert. And this idea of working in concert is exactly what that law is about. And so to stretch it out, it may be a bit further than it was intended, but at the same time, the notion of what's underneath it, I think, does have some traction.
How do you see these kinds of cases going compared to what the congressional panel is doing? I mean, do you think that this is actually going to be on a track that moves faster, perhaps?
Well, it might. I mean, I think the real concern with what Congress is doing right now on these hearings is that it's very likely we're going to see a flip in the House. And if there's a flip in the House coming up in a year, what you're going to see is every single one of those hearings simply disappear, because the Republicans will be in control. And they have been obstructing every single investigation since the beginning of this. They've tried to rebrand this as something else, to characterize it as something else. Since they have done that, there's no reason to assume they wouldn't do it again.
You heard, I'm sure as everybody else did, President Biden's fiery speech in Statuary Hall, the place where it was overrun by the rioters on January 6th, a year ago. Do you think that with the statements that he made and the remarks that he made about the former president, that he has changed any minds in the Republican Party?
No. I think that what we have seen from Republicans very early on was an acknowledgement of what this was, and then a very quick pivot. It seems to me now what we're finding is that there is almost a requirement in order to be in a position of power, heck, maybe even any position within the Republican Party, you need to be pushing the big lie argument. And the idea that you would see anybody change at this point seems unlikely. The very small number of Republicans who have come out acknowledging what happened on those days and what the evidence objectively seems to be pointing towards have been diminishing. And they have been attacked from all sides. They're getting challenged in primaries. And my expectation is that there will be fewer and fewer of those during the next election.
That was criminal defense lawyer and former prosecutor Jack Rice. He was speaking with me late last week. That's all we have for you today on International Edition. On behalf of managing editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us.
On the next Straight Talk Africa. We'll take a look at informal housing. As cities develop, are we making space for them in big urban centers? Join me, Haiti Adams, for that discussion on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 8